Welcome back to another episode of Vanguard Radio. Today we're going to have a special emphasis on COVID-19. We're going to talk a little bit about double layer security, gray zones, and the effects of potential security attacks during a crisis. Joining us today is Valerie Finley, and she's speaking with us from home. She is Research Fellow, National Police Foundation, American Society for Evidence-Based Policing. She has a master's in sociology, as well as a master's in terrorism study. Valerie, welcome to Vanguard Radio.
Thanks, John. I'm pleased to be here.
Valerie, to begin, you've got some very interesting credentials. For the benefit of our listenership and readership, could you tell us a little bit more about your background?
Yeah, for sure. So I have about 20 years experience in cyber and in national intelligence in US and Canada. I started in IT security, so that was long before cyber was ever coined a term, and have worked primarily in government, but have also worked in private sector and various partnerships internationally.
So where do we start? I guess from my side, what exactly is double layer vulnerability?
So I guess it requires a fairly broad discussion. So I guess the best place to start is to talk about sort of how we view security in general. So whether, and I'm going to talk about it sort of domain agnostically, we've always looked at security in general through particular domains, their assets, their vulnerabilities, and then the threats that could be exacted upon them. Now what we're seeing is more of a view, I don't know how much of this has been operationalized, but looking at security and its planning and assessments more from dynamic state opposed to threats and actors. So we're looking at the states of impact when we have a particular crisis or a threat. So if we look at COVID-19, one of the important things to recognize about COVID being a pandemic, and this would apply to an epidemic as well if it were just here in Canada, is that there's a number of systems that are impacted. So there's the physical well-being and psychological of the population. There's the social, right? So how we move about, how we behave. Actually, if you look at 9/11, it's a really good example. So 9/11, although that was a terrorist activity, that had a very deep impact on how people behaved, what they did, what their normal habitus was, and that had a cascade effect across a number of different sectors, like if we look at the airline sector in particular. Also, there's economic, political, there's social services and support, and then there's national security in all these areas of impacts when we have a major national crisis like we have right now.
So basically, in times of crisis, there are a lot of areas of potential exposure.
Yes, and I think when we've gone through security assessments before and security planning exercises, we look at specific threats. And when we think about threats, we think about malicious and non-malicious. So we can have malicious where it's a state actor or a particular nation or adversary that's attacked one of our systems. And that could be a utility system. It could be data or information related to national security. So it could be multiple domains. And when we look at something like a pandemic, that's obviously non-malicious. It is, we presume, it's come out of a situation that was geographically distanced from us. And once it's arrived here in Canada, we're starting to see how the impacts are cascading, as we would expect, to a state. So we're looking at the state of the nation today, the state of how things are in Canada. And what we're seeing is, obviously, we went through a period of, people were, obviously very panicked and very scared. So we saw, people doing a lot of buying. They put an enormous amount of stress on our supply systems. And then we start seeing the questions around what this pandemic actually is, what it means with very limited information because it is a new virus, and what that means to employment and what that means to our government services in shoring up the income and revenues that are not going to be afforded to our businesses and to our citizens. So as these things roll out, we start to see we start at the top of a pyramid of one thing happening and a number of things being impacted as we go along. what that creates is a broader state of vulnerability. And the reason I bring that up is one of the hot topics in Canada and the U.S. in military has been gray zone. So gray zone tactics or hybrid warfare are meant to create a vulnerability or a vulnerable state where democracy can be attacked. What we're seeing right now is we're almost in an artificial state or an artificial gray zone where we are left even more vulnerable. So it becomes even more important to have, going back to what you were asking about, this, you know, double layer security. It's really more multispectral. So you're looking at one particular problem and all the problems that problem can beget, and then all the solutions that are required to shore up each of those individual problems so that you can restore a state of normalcy or normal operations in a situation where you're in a crisis.
Valerie, what exactly are gray zones?
So gray zones, so it's actually known as gray zone tactics, or sometimes it's referred to as hybrid warfare, or sometimes gray zone warfare for that matter. So what gray zone actions are, so these would be actions that adversaries, so, and this is very broad, so other nations or nation sympathizers or disruptors would use that are below the threshold of actual warfare, so what we consider to be traditional warfare. So it's like the non-military means to achieve whatever their geopolitical objectives may be. So gray zone actions might include things like election meddling, economic coercion, the ambiguous use of unconventional forces, and these adversaries, when they're utilizing these actions, they use all tools at their disposal. So they will use things like sanctions, misinformation, cultural, religion, or technology avenues, and all of this is meant, all of these actions are meant to erode a nation's democracy. So these objectives or the agenda by the adversary essentially targets these national assets or economy or politics by utilizing those tools to attack the stability of a nation overall. So they're very coercive, very covert, very hard to detect, very hard to prevent, and also very hard to control. Social media obviously has a huge play in that. So these narratives and how we perceive them and how our governments and militaries respond to them become really important in maintaining our democracy as well as the overall stability of a nation. The situation that we're in currently with the crisis leaves us somewhat more susceptible to these types of gray zone actions because we're already essentially in a state of vulnerability. So to what effect do we have a very good eye on our ability to manage additional threats should we have one when we're already in a state of crisis?
Valerie, can you talk a little bit about prevention, detection, response, and recovery strategies? What does it mean? What does it do? And how does it help assist in a situation like this?
Sure. So essentially, we look at security assessments of any domain in these four categories. So there are four phases related to an incident. So there's prevention, detection, response, recovery. So prevention is essentially all of the things that you have in place that would prevent whatever threats you've identified against whatever particular assets you're trying to protect. Now, ideally, you do this well in advance. You will do all this planning and make a determination on what those safeguards are. And then around that, you'll encapsulate the detection. So you'll want to detect the threats that you've identified and maybe some unknown threats as well around that asset. So you've got your countermeasures, you'll have your detection, which is sometimes people will hear us talk about monitoring. So that would be a detection piece. And then there's the response. So how do you respond should you have an incident? And then how do you recover? And how you respond and how you recover are really interesting because they're sort of on the other side of you've had an incident. So if you're looking at the response phase, you're looking at all of the things, people, processes, tools that are required to respond to the situation, to neutralize it and isolate it, and then so that you can move on to recovery. So you're looking for that whatever that benchmark of stabilization that you've identified is, attaining that, and then you can begin your recovery activities. Your recovery activities, there's a lot of metrics that are wrapped around this. So there's recovery times, there's recovery capabilities. So to what level of operations do you need to be recovered to within a certain amount of time? So all of these things are really key to cybersecurity in particular. Other areas of security don't necessarily employ them, but those phases represent a really good framework for literally any type of security incident or any crisis. Two other pieces that we look at are, and this is again prior to in preparation for an incident, are attack vectors and then attack surfaces. So the attack vectors are the avenues into a particular asset that we need to recognize so that we can manage them, put mitigation around them and safeguards, and also possibly detection. Attack surfaces is the surface that a threat could operate on. So we often talk about reducing our attack surfaces. So that means almost a decentralization of certain assets so that those surfaces are smaller and much more manageable. So these three pieces are really important in cyber, in particular, and responding to particular threat scenarios. If we flip that and go back to what I was saying about states, so if we take our eyes off of threat scenarios and we look at states, so an end result of a particular impact in maybe a worst case scenario, and maybe there's a staggered view towards that, that becomes a very different view in terms of risk mitigation, because you're not managing an actual threat anymore. You're managing an end state, which becomes very important when you look at attack vectors and attack surfaces.
So it's almost like a chess game. You've really got to try to anticipate each move and what the exposure is. In your opinion, are we prepared for this?
I think we're seeing that we're not. And I think, there's a lot of evidence of that right now. And, I've obviously a background in security and as well as sociology. So I'm seeing some interesting, behaviors and cascade effects in how people are dealing with this crisis and our governments as well. So, we're so interconnected that this is creating other problems, at the social, psychological levels, economic, political, as we saw yesterday. So it becomes really important to ensure during this response and recovery period, which is essentially what we're in, so that we can maintain a level of stability, that we're not borrowing data and that we're looking at the specifics around this pandemic and what it means to Canada and then lower down to the provinces, to the municipalities, by their demographic. So data and models need to be based on calculated incidence, prevalence, and to that specific demographic, and then described in risk frameworks of possibility and then probability. What we're seeing is an inconsistency across the board. And of course, with social media, it's becoming even more, alarming and confusing to people, because they're not hearing a consistent message overall. And on social media, that's when it's impossible to control. However, from the government perspective, the messages at the federal level, the provincial, and the municipal need to be very coherent and very, very consistent and very managed, recognizing that, any statements that could relate to conflation or conjecture around the, potential and possible threats and resulting impacts can have a very deep effect on people's psychological well-being, as well as their normal social habitus and how they behave in the time of crisis and then afterwards.
I see that our Prime Minister has been very active in addressing Canadian citizens, but do you think the social media is playing a role perhaps in creating unnecessary panic?
Well, and I think this goes back to the discussion around gray zone, right? So you have to wonder in this time of crisis for us and for the U.S., you know, they're obviously our partners. To what extent are we seeing the same misinformation tactics and disruption that we saw during election periods? We were well aware that this was occurring at the national security and intelligence levels. So what we're seeing on social media, to what extent are some of those messages manufactured to create this destabilization? Noting that at that micro level, the individual level in societies, that affects things as you go up. So the individual level, if there's destabilization, that affects how we group as a society, and then how we act as a collective, being probably the nation is probably the best description. So the messages that we see on social media, you know, these are really unattributed, right? So we don't necessarily know where some of these are coming from. They're flashing before our eyes as we're looking at our news feed. And to what extent is that affecting how we feel as we're managing the situation? Because it's important to recognize, I think this is probably one of the first incidents that is really at the practical level impacted people unilaterally. So the ones that are actually listening and that are self-isolating, we haven't really seen that in our generation. So it's a huge departure away from what we're used to. And I think, you know, the effect of that is really worth noting. So we're seeing other, you know, other pieces come into play as well, where, you know, the messages we're hearing from government are very much, you know, motherhood hectoring type statements that are meant to restore confidence and or to, you know, maintain confidence in our government, and that we'll be taken care of and everything will be okay. The services will be there and available to the people. But unfortunately, what we're seeing, again, on social media are reports that some of these essential services, not workplaces, but essential services, their capacity, accessibility, and availability are not there. So what is broken down? So when we have a collective, we had 1 million people applying for EI, what is that doing to the systems that the people are relying on to make that application for relief? What we're hearing is that the systems are overloaded, there's confusion around the process, and it's not clear how to successfully maneuver that entire transaction. That becomes a narrative that propagates, you know, very well in social media. We're hearing also the same with some of the banks, right? So we're hearing a lot of the conversations around mortgage deferrals and loan relief and that sort of thing. But to what extent is that actually occurring? So I guess where I'm going with that is, you know, that becomes a part of that risk management framework when you're looking at, you know, a threat situation or a crisis situation. You define those assets, what are important, what has to be available, accessible, and has to have the capacity to serve during those times of crises. And how does that actually play out when a crisis actually occurs? I don't think we've ever gone through that exercise, you know, nor I don't think the U.S. has either. So it's a really important point of reflection where we are now to mark these as areas of, you know, concern and further scrutiny as, well, once we recover from this, as we go forward, because they are so essential to the fundamental operations of, you know, our cities, societies, and the country as a whole.
Well, you know, I certainly have a lot of empathy, as I'm sure you do, for all of the people who are suffering the impact of COVID-19. But to a certain degree, this is also a test of our policies and procedures. I feel that there will be some learning outcomes that will come out of this, and there'll also be probably new policies and procedures. Like, you've mentioned social media, and there's a lot of really good, reliable, responsible sources. But there's also a lot of sources that are not necessarily responsible or have their own agendas, which could be affecting things in a negative way, contributing to a lack of confidence, contributing to panic. And One of the articles I was reading posted the other day was by an infectious disease doctor who said, you know, we have this issue of this problem, but in a way, I'm really concerned about the cure, because what effect will that have on future generations and how they view how we manage viruses and what level of control and responsibility, what systems will be in place? You hear a lot in the newswire these days about people being more concerned about the solution than the actual cause. Would you care to comment on that? And what steps, what could we be doing better?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for, what that scientist observed, because I think we're in a new territory, right? And I think it may not be net new. I think we have seen, obviously, pandemics like this in the past. However, now we're in a new era where, if we keep in mind our legislation around some of this, is decades old. So the legislation, policies, and regulations that we have in place, because they're decades old, we see where there may not be the effectiveness as they were intended to have based on when they were actually scribed. So the interconnected world that we have now, and it highly globalized, which is also a really important factor, how well-traveled our world is, the ease of travel, the speed of travel, and also how much we depend on some of these technologies to just perform our day-to-day activities, becomes a really big consideration in not only legislation, but also in risk planning. So when you look at something like a virus, the normal human behavior and psychological response to that is what we're seeing today. People are scared, and that's normal. But what do we do to mitigate that? And I argue that there are things that can be done to mitigate that. The messages on social media, the messages from our governments have to be stronger, more immediate, and more direct than what people are hearing in social media. You can never resolve all doubt, but that's what you're competing with. So there's a narrative out there that can't be controlled in social media other than speaking over top of it and being more... more, I wouldn't say transparent, because I think there's some elements of this that there's some things people need to know and there's other things that they need to be assured of. And I think the two are very different. But being able to, manage what people are seeing and hearing on social media can't be done in social media. It can only be done from the messages that we're receiving, from our leadership.
So, Valerie, to get a little more specific, can you comment on more specific issues related to security? I mean, COVID-19 is to some degree an opportunity if there are vulnerabilities. So what are some of the specific security threats?
So I think right now we're seeing obviously a stress on the basics of, just our operating society. So we don't have a stress on our food supply system or manufacturing as we know it. That, in fact, would have been a really great message to get out early on from government at all levels to help people understand that they don't need to go buy huge amounts of food, because domestically we have, our own supply chain. We also do rely on the U.S., but there's enough to sustain us, and I think that was a message that was missing. The strain of availability, accessibility, and capacity on some of our technology systems, where people are required to go online, noting that not everybody has internet access in our country, that these systems are stressed. So, people are reporting, having to wait hours on the phone, or if they're online, that their sessions are timing out because of just the sheer volume of traffic that's associated with whatever that service is. So, these are things that we want to look at, because, again, it adds to that psychological impact. So it's the very basics of the services and systems that are there for the relief of the general populace are not working, are not accessible, or aren't available to them. That becomes another compounded aspect of how people perceive and behave in a time of crisis and how they react. So I think, you know, it becomes a multispectral security exercise. You can't take, you know, one piece and silo it and assess it and just, you know, develop mitigation measures around it because you've defined that as an asset. The assets across the board are the assets that maintain the overall well-being of our nation and then its people. So that becomes a very big, broad exercise with a lot of interconnected systems, but it becomes crucial. And it becomes crucial in looking at it through various lenses, so various lenses that would represent a crisis type or a particular event. By doing that, you're coming up with different measures, different mitigations to counter whatever the negative effects are of that crisis or event. And I think that's where we're having a very difficult time of it right now with, if, again, going back to essential services and people being able to access those services that are standing in the way of them receiving, you know, put bluntly, money. That's money that pays rent, that pays utility, that buys foods. And if that's not available, to what extent is that person able to sustain themselves? Do they become part of another social system down the road, whether it's welfare or bankruptcy? So those cascade effects are really important to recognize. And the metrics are all there, which is a really great thing. We already know in terms of the country, what percentage of the country is two paychecks away from bankruptcy or that has X number of months in savings available to them. So we can plan for these scenarios based on the metrics we have. And by putting those particular incidents or crises lenses over top of it, it gives us a better view of what we need to do to maintain that stability when these things happen.
Well, data certainly is a power, and I'm sure there will be learning outcomes that come out of this, and it will be probably to some degree a game changer for how we act should there ever be another pandemic in the future. You're listening to Vanguard Radio, and we have had the pleasure of speaking with Valerie Finley, Research Fellow, National Police Foundation, American Society for Evidence-Based Policing, with a master's in sociology and a master's in terrorism studies. Valerie, I want to thank you for joining Vanguard Radio this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks, John.